this is a special treat. And before me are two people who normally I would just be looking at and not doing much else with, because they would be doing all of the talking and the interviewing. I speak, of course, Samantha Burt and her escort, Kevin Middleton. I say escort because tonight we're going to be focusing on pretty much what Samantha was all about, although she did have assistance with Kevin. Welcome, Sam.
Hi, Mike. Great to be here on the other side of the microphone, sort of, although I'm on the same side, but I'm also on the other side.
Well, that's right.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having us here.
Yeah, great. So as we put out there on Facebook, et cetera, this is a situation where what we're doing is reflecting back on a number of issues that were discussed, I think, at least four programs that you did with Bridge to Everywhere. And these programs were designed to explore issues associated with, I guess it's safe to say, the movie Blackfish and all that that encompasses. And it encompasses quite a bit. So that's the major issue.
Yeah, and we also talked about the book Death at SeaWorld as well. And we talked to a former trainer. We did two interviews with a former SeaWorld trainer. So we kind of covered the issue from
and
a lot of different
Kirby,
angles.
And then David Kirby, the author of Death at SeaWorld.
Right.
Yeah, Death at SeaWorld. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So you're back from a trip to Europe. And I'm going to let you just go for it. Why did you go to Europe?
Well, I went to Europe it was a tour with the movie Blackfish. So I did 7 countries and 9 screenings of the movie in about 22 days. So I started out in Madrid, and then from Madrid I went to Brussels, and then directly to Luxembourg, where we had a screening in Esch, and then back to Brussels. We did a screening in Leuven in Belgium, and then also in Brussels. And then from Brussels, I went and did a stealth mission at Laurel Park in the Canary Islands, which I will talk about later. And then from the Canary Islands, I went to Amsterdam, did a screening there. And then from Amsterdam back to Brussels to speak to the European Parliament. And then from there, we went to Munich, and then Milan, and then Naples, and then to London. So it was quite a trip. The last screening was at the London Science Museum, which was pretty cool to be there.
And I caught up with Sam in Brussels, meeting with the European Parliament, and I was there for the second half.
Yeah, so midway through. Yeah. But the trip was sponsored by the Born Free organization in the UK.
Okay.
And Born Free has been around for 30 years. They're an animal welfare, animal rights organization, very well respected. They were started, you've probably seen the movie Born Free from 1964.
I have, yes.
Yeah, so Virginia McKenna and her husband, Bill Travers, who starred in the movie, Virginia played Joy Amundsen, and it's a story about a couple who are living in Africa, and I believe the husband is a game warden, and there's a lion that kills someone in a village nearby.
Sure.
And so this game warden has to go out and shoot this lion. It's not a particularly politically correct movie anymore, but then the female lion, the male lion's partner comes and attacks him as well. So they kill the female lion, and then they have these 3 cubs that they find, and they end up raising them. So
Elsie, I think, was the
Elsa.
Right.
Elsa.
Right.
Yeah. Elsa. Yeah, there's 3 cubs, and then eventually 2 of them go to a zoo, and then one of them stays with Joy and her husband. And so Virginia McKenna and Bill Travers played this couple who raised these 3 lion cubs, and eventually they're just raising Elsa, and Elsa eventually becomes a problem, and she's not really integrating well as a wild animal anymore there. And so they try to integrate her back into, literally back into the wild. And eventually,
right,
after a lot of struggling, she ends up going back into the wild, and she has cubs. So she integrates back into the wild. And Joy went back apparently and visited her several times. And so Virginia was really, I think, really just inspired by this whole story and playing this amazing female character. And then eventually she and her husband founded this organization called Born Free, and they've really been really put themselves out there for the past 30 years trying to get the case across that there are certain animals that don't belong in zoos, and that zoos, in fact, are not – there's some zoos out there that are not necessarily doing real conservation. So that's really what they've been working for the last 30 years.
Okay. Well, That in itself is an incredible story.
Yeah. And then, well, we actually got to stay with Virginia, which she's, I think she's 82 years old now. Is that right?
She is.
82,
oh,
84.
That,
yeah.
That's so, hard to believe.
Yeah. She's living in this little house in the English countryside. And
so the little cottage is this really sweet little home.
Yeah. And it's adorned with BAFTAs because she's won several, British and Film TV Awards.
They use her as a bathroom stop in the door there.
Yeah. So she's kind of an icon in England. She's a well-known actress. And so to stay with her was amazing. And then one morning I had to get up at 3:30 because I had an early morning interview on one of the English morning shows. And so I literally had to leave the house at 4:30. So I had to wake up at 3:30 to get in the shower. And Virginia said, "Oh, I'll make you tea." And I said, "No, you won't. She's 82 years old. Don't get up and make me tea." And she did, actually. I was leaving my room at 3:30 in the morning, and she was tiptoeing down the stairs after dropping off a tray of English tea for me. So it was quite an experience.
This obviously is a trip that has many different components. Let's go back and say, though, Blackfish has appeared. It's now available. It's being viewed as a movie. It's had its impact here. There's been a book. We've talked about it. You've done many appearances in a variety of places where the movie was shown, in Anchorage and other, all around the country. This organization, how did it pick up and decide to do this European piece, and how did you get involved with it?
Well, the way it went down is a guy named Daniel Turner, who's been working with Born Free for about 14 years. I guess you can call him a lobbyist for animal welfare. He saw the movie, and he saw the potential for Blackfish to do something that hadn't been done in the animal welfare, animal rights community, similar to what's going on in the U.S., in the U.K., in the EU. There's a lot of different organizations working at cross purposes, and they don't always get together and agree on things. And so it's very hard to get the ear of, in the EU, it would be the parliamentarians, it would be Congress or your senators. If you're not speaking the same the same story. If everybody's not all together on the same story, it's kind of hard to get people's attention. And so I think what Daniel saw in this movie was the potential for it to unite many different NGOs or non-government organizations around this one particular topic of cetaceans in captivity, so dolphins and whales in captivity. There's a lot of great organizations in the EU doing work on this topic, but he felt like this movie could actually unify all these groups and bring them together by getting them to work together on this tour. So that's what he did. Born Free was the primary sponsor of the tour, but then there were many other animal welfare, animal rights organizations. There's SOS Delfines, SOS Delfini, another organization called LAV, which started out as an anti-vivisection group. There's Whale and Dolphin Conservation as well. So all these organizations, he contacted people in several different organizations, and he said, "Hey, we want to show this movie in all over Europe and in the UK. And are you interested in sponsoring this?" So it started a conversation, and I think it really brought people together. In the meantime, he was also working with many of these groups to pull together a report about dolphinaria in the EU to come up with to have people actually go and observe various different dolphinariums to see how much education was actually happening at these places. So right around the time I was doing this tour with Blackfish, a group that got together that created a website called endcap.eu. Mm-hmm. So endcap.eu, they put out a paper that looked at what is the educational content of shows at dolphinariums and marine parks around Europe. And they actually found that, in fact, out of a 20 or 30 minute show, in some cases it's about 30 seconds, maybe a minute of actual educational content. So it was a pretty serious report, and that was coming out at the same time that I was there doing this tour. So I think it was a really good time to have that coincide, so that we could then go to the European Parliament and talk to some of the parliamentarians, not just about the movie, but about just the state of dolphinaria in the EU. The UK no longer has dolphinariums, even though there are still many people working against captivity in the rest of the world. But the UK, at some point, the rules were changed, so it made it a quite hard to open a dolphinarium or maintain a dolphinarium. It got a lot more cost prohibitive, so they no longer have them there.
But that's not the case around the rest of
No, there's over 300 country. Dolphins in Europe right now in captivity.
Okay.
And there are also killer whales as well. There's killer whales at Marineland Antibes in France, and then also in the Canary Islands at Laurel Park. And Laurel Park's actually talked about in the movie Blackfish.
So I'm struck by the point that you just made, that you spoke before a political group, and I'm searching my own memory to say how has any of that kind of presentation to political powers been done here in the United States, for example?
Well, we didn't actually get to present to a political group yet. What we did was we met with one of the assistants from the parliamentarian from Denmark.
Okay.
And then we met with two other parliamentarians, one from Greece and one from Italy.
Okay.
And which to me, actually, as an aside, it was amazing the access that that people in Europe have to their parliamentarians. It was really surprising to me. I mean, Daniel from Born Free has been working in the animal welfare world for 14 years, but still it surprised me that we were able to walk right into parliament and speak with the one of the assistants as well as two of the parliamentarians directly. And what we were talking about there was just, would they be interested in showing blackfish at the European Parliament at both of the locations, both
when
in Brussels.
Meet in March.
Yeah, they meet. And hopefully it's going to show in March at both the Brussels location and the Strasbourg, France location. So that's what we were trying to get one of the parliamentarians to sponsor the showing of the film. And it looks like we've now potentially, we don't know this for sure, but it looks like there'll be one sponsor for the Strasbourg, France location and one sponsor for the Brussels location.
So what we're talking about is the umbrella organization of the European Union.
That, yes.
Rather than individual countries.
Exactly. So the parliament, I didn't really know much about how the parliament works before I went to Europe on this tour, so I learned quite a bit. And what I've understood from talking to Daniel is that the parliamentarians are setting policy. They're not actually setting law, but they're setting policy for the European Union, mm-hmm. and then the parliamentarians go back to their individual states or countries, and then laws are made based on the policy that's been set by the parliament. So if we can get a policy change in the European Parliament in terms of dolphins and whales in captivity, then that will translate to the individual countries changing their laws, potentially.
So knowing that the system is different there than our own system here in the United States, what is happening here nationwide, for example, in this regard?
Well, that's interesting because in Europe and the UK, what seems to be driving this anti-captivity movement is the NGOs. It's the non-government organizations. At least that's what we were seeing. There's a lot of NGOs, and then there's a lot of smaller groups that are working together. What we're seeing here is more of it's kind of like a social movement right now. We're seeing a lot of activity on Twitter and Facebook. There's been a huge saturation with social media. And I think what really, of course, the movie came out at the Sundance Film Festival in January, and I was able to go to that. And it had been showing in film festivals all over the world and all over the country. But it wasn't until the CNN showing on October 24th that it really got a huge amount of airplay. I think it was 1.4 million people saw the movie on the first night that it was shown. Oh. And then CNN had a poll after that, and 86% of the people polled after watching Blackfish said they would not go to a place like SeaWorld, and they wouldn't take their kids to a place like SeaWorld. And then then CNN subsequently showed the movie another, I think they've shown it a total of 12 times.
Okay.
And so the estimation is about over 20 million people have seen the movie just on CNN. And now it's, of course, on iTunes, and it's on Amazon On Demand, and it's on Netflix. So even more people are getting to see it. And what we're seeing in social media
30 million subscribers to Netflix now have access to it on its most popular category.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's right. Last night we actually were looking at a movie to watch on Netflix, and we looked at the most popular list, and Blackfish was up there on most downloaded.
Well, I can testify that Lee and I were not able to get to the showings in the theaters, but we did download it from iTunes. We noticed that it was there, and it certainly was there in a new, I mean, it's very fairly prominent. So looking at this, you've been associated with this whole process for some time. It sounds as if the interest is continuing to build. When you start talking about a million, 20 million, that kind of thing, You have a lot of people who have looked at it, and the question is, how does that translate into action, specifically since this all starts with SeaWorld?
Yeah, so what's happening now is the past couple of weeks has been pretty amazing. SeaWorld had scheduled a concert series in February, and they invited musical artists to participate in this concert, and there was a list that they put out on their website of who the artists were going to be, and there's a guy named Mike Garrett in Niagara Falls, and he's part of he's not actually a former trainer at Marineland, but he's been helping some of the former trainers at Marineland who've been sued by the owners of Marineland for millions of dollars because they've been speaking out against the company. And Mike got a hold of this list, and he saw that the Bare Naked Ladies were going to be playing at SeaWorld for this concert. Okay. And so he said, well, I think what I'm going to do is start a petition and say, hey, Bare Naked Ladies, you guys should check out Blackfish. And we know that you're a socially conscious band. Maybe you want to consider not performing at SeaWorld. Mm-hmm. So he started this petition, and it did make it to the Bare Naked Ladies. And then they put out a press release and said, in fact, we have seen the movie Blackfish. We watch movies, too. And we really appreciate our fan feedback. You know, we've grown up with our fans, and we want to listen to what our fans are saying. So we are pulling out of the SeaWorld concert series. And that started a domino effect of other petitions and other bands pulling out. And at this point, we've had, to this date, I think it's 8 bands have pulled out. It's been Bare Naked Ladies. The next, Willie Nelson was the next band to pull out, which is rather amazing.
That's a big deal.
Yeah, and he was actually interviewed on CNN, and he said his granddaughter, was it his great-granddaughter, I can't remember,
his great-granddaughter
came to him with a petition with 250 signatures asking him not to perform at SeaWorld, and then Hart canceled. Let's see, there's
REO Speedwagon, 38 Special.
Cheap Trick, 38 Special. Who am I missing?
Martina McBride.
Yeah, Trisha Yearwood. And so there's only a couple of artists left. There's
Justin
Cole Moore and Scotty McCreary, I think, are the only two that are still scheduled. But there's more.
Go for it.
Joan Jett actually said she had a put out a cease and desist to ask SeaWorld to not use her music in their shows anymore. And Tommy Lee also said the same thing. So there's artists all over who are now being petitioned. If they've got a song in one of SeaWorld's shows, they have a night magic show where they use popular music and they, you know, shoot off fireworks and you know, it's a light show basically where the whales do circus tricks. And so now there's performers who even have one song in that show.
Hayes from Savage Garden.
Oh, yeah, right. Savage Garden
tweeted out, this is a quote from him. He said, I've been a vocal advocate for the movie Blackfish. I had no idea my song was used in the parks. I've written to my publisher.
Yeah, so there you go. Yeah. So we have artists speaking out. I mean, people are asking their favorite artists either if they have a song at SeaWorld, ask SeaWorld if they would drop it, and if you don't have one, don't play for SeaWorld. Don't agree to go play there. So that's huge. I mean, talk about cultural saturation. I mean, it's making a huge impact. And so the next thing that we're looking at after the holidays is Southwest Airlines, because Southwest, of course, has several of their airplanes painted to look like Shamu Whale. And so, you know, look at, they give out toys to little kids to, you know, of, you know, killer whales, and they are perpetuating this idea that captivity is okay. So, and then, you know, we've got several different photos out on the internet now of Southwest and their Shamu plane juxtaposed with what's actually going on.
So do you have any information about direct contact with Southwest on the issue? Or
not yet, but, you know, we're about to put forward kind of a coordinated media campaign just to let them know that we are, we're serious about telling businesses that do, you know, that work with SeaWorld directly that, you know, this is, we want to get this message across that if you're doing business with SeaWorld, then people will choose not to do business with you. Macy's, for example, they had a SeaWorld float in the Macy's parade this year. And for about a month leading up to the parade, there was quite a bit of protesting against Macy's.
Alec Baldwin
wrote a letter asking Macy's not to have the float in the SeaWorld parade. They did actually go forward with it, and I think it was probably a PR mistake. One of the differences about about between SeaWorld and Southwest is that apparently Southwest is a rather PR savvy company. So whereas SeaWorld is just kind of hunkered down in their bunker and every once in a while they say the same thing over again that they've been saying for 50 years, Southwest, from what I've heard, tends to listen to their critics and they change. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what we want to do is give them an opportunity to change and do the right thing. You know, again, it's not just boycotting companies for fun. It's like saying, hey, this is a serious issue, and the fact that you're flying these planes, you're really advertising for SeaWorld, and do you actually know what goes on behind the scenes? So we really want to give them a sense of what's going on there.
Earlier on, you said we. So I'm looking at two people. I'm seeing Kevin and I'm seeing Sam.
Yeah, the two of us.
But who's the we?
So there's several different we's. There's the we of the for there was one trainer who spoke out after Don Brancio was killed in mm-hmm. In SeaWorld of Orlando in February of 2010. That's Dr. Jeffrey Ventry. So he's really the first person first former trainer who stepped forward and actually spoke out against the company and just started to talk about what goes on behind the scenes. And then he was joined by Dr. John Jett. He's a professor at Stetson University in Florida, and the two of them together wrote a paper called "Keto and Tillicum Express the Stress of Captivity," and that's available on the internet. Tim Zimmerman, who is a journalist for Outside Magazine, interviewed both John and Jeff in a story called "Killer in the Pool."
Okay.
And at that point, I read that story, and so did another former trainer named Carol Ray. And we had been friends with Jeff and John in the 90s. We'd worked together. And so we formed a group called Voice of the Orcas. And there's a website. It's a Google group. If you just Google Voice of the Orcas, you'll see our website. So we came together and started getting information out there. At the same time, Tim Zimmerman, who wrote the article "Killer in the Pool," he started a Google group. And we invited people. I actually wasn't there at the genesis. I was invited to the Google group several months after it started. And whale activists, journalists, filmmakers, scientists all were invited to this group. Mm-hmm. And so we all came together and started sharing information. And it's morphed into something huge now, and it's including NGOs, representatives from the Humane Society, the Animal Welfare Institute. We have Dr. Naomi Rose, who's working for the Animal Welfare Institute, was at the Humane Society. Dr. Ingrid Visser, who swims with whales in New Zealand. Dr. Lori Marino, who's an expert on cetacean neuroscience. So, and then just people who've been whale advocates. We have Howard Garrett from the Orca Network, who's been working to try to free Lolita, who's a story we actually talked about Lolita last year when we talked about mm-hmm. death at SeaWorld. So just a group of people that have kind of come together loosely. Some of them are in more formal non-government organizations, but most people just have a passion for this issue. Journalists like David Kirby, Elizabeth Batt, Candace Calloway-Whiting, people who've been writing on this issue for years, but we didn't really have a sort of a network of people where we could pull information together. So that's sort of, when I say we, it starts in that group and then it kind of fans out to social media from there, because everybody's got connections and different non-government organizations that they support or journalists that they give information to. So mm-hmm. it's a big we.
Yeah, and the we keeps growing because mm-hmm. at this point you have families, you have school kids, you have the grassroots explosion of passion and compassion for the whales from seeing that movie. You have high school kids putting out videos challenging SeaWorld to respond. They won't ever go back until SeaWorld changes the way they take care of the whales.
There's a group of kids in Manchester, England, who also put out a video about whales in captivity. They had a teacher who likes to train his kids on how to use social media, and so they put together this great 2-minute video, and it got several thousand views on the mm-hmm. on the internet.
And it's decentralized, mm-hmm. so it's not, you know, it's just really an organic cultural tipping point that's happening.
Kind of mm-hmm. like the Occupy movement.
Sure. So I think I have a picture of that. And as you've described it, there are a variety of organizations that are interested, and you've spoken about the one that you formed, but that this is not a centrally directed process. And obviously, in the modern world, when something catches people's attention and you have something such as the movie, which in some respects is a kind of a central reference point for what you're doing, absent the movie, it would, in my mind, be difficult to convey what you're talking about.
Well, we had the book Death at SeaWorld. Sure. I mean, David Kirby's sure. book is amazing. And whenever anybody asks, where do I go after seeing seeing Blackfish, you know, the first place I see is go read David Kirby's book. And also David Kirby writes for TakePart.com, and I think he's got 30 different articles now up there that he's written since Death at SeaWorld. It might even be more.
Sure.
So, I mean, it's an incredible resource, and it did catalyze some movement, but because Blackfish is a movie, you know, and the movie has a little bit more cultural saturation than a book, although I think I just heard that David Kirby was saying that the printing, like the paperback at Amazon, it keeps selling out, so they keep having to print more.
Right.
So the book's really been selling out since the movie came out.
So the question probably that you know, I'm hearing a pretty broad interest and action on the part of many people, young and old, and so on. But the real question that I'd like to explore, and we'll do this in the second half of what we're going to be doing here, is what signs of any impact on SeaWorld that all of this brings. So I'm here with Samantha Burke, who's just back from the European tour on the issue of the Blackfish book, movie, and underlying issues associated with SeaWorld having killer whales in captivity. And I'm also here with Kevin Middleton, who accompanied Sam on part of that trip. And we're going to be back right after the bottom of the hour. And this is KBRF. We are Radio Free Palmer, broadcasting from downtown Palmer, beautiful downtown Palmer, a dark and cold evening. And that's the story. So we're back. Now let's say the question, with all of the activity and all of the viewing of the movie and the reading of the book and the protest, what has SeaWorld done? You've suggested that they're hunkering down. Do you have any sense, for example, that the numbers of people that are going to SeaWorld have declined or what?
Well, their second quarter numbers declined. We're still waiting to see about specifically their fourth quarter earnings, because really the cultural saturation happened in October. You know, this is when it really,
right,
you know, when everything really exploded. More people saw the movie in October than had seen it up to that point, you know, by millions. So we're looking at that. Several of the stockholders at SeaWorld have been dumping serious amounts of stock. The stock price has been going down steadily since Blackfish came out.
So this is public.
SeaWorld was owned by Anheuser-Busch when I worked for them. In fact, when I worked for them, they had just been purchased by Anheuser-Busch from the publishing company Harcourt Brace Yovanovitch.
Okay.
And then Anheuser-Busch took them over, and then Blackstone had purchased them, unfortunately, shortly before both Alexis Martinez's death and Don's death. So they picked them up just a little bit before that happened. And so then they had an initial public offering and were spinning them off. And in that process, Securities and Exchange Commission actually said they looked at all the paperwork for the IPO, and they said, well, actually, before you go forward with this IPO, you need to mention some of the challenges that this company is facing. And the challenges that that they were asked to put in their paperwork were three things. One was the book Death at SeaWorld. Number two was this OSHA case that was just gone into appeal. And the third thing was the movie Blackfish. So even the Securities and Exchange Commission was acknowledging the fact that the book and the movie and this OSHA trial that they're dealing with, they're still waiting for an answer on appeal whether trainers have to remain behind barriers during the shows and when they're interacting with the whales. So those three things they were told they had to put that in for their paperwork. So I think that's pretty serious that it's been recognized that this is potentially making an impact.
Sure.
Over in Europe, we know that a lot of the NGOs are in talks with some of the larger tourism companies, because those are the people that send people to places like SeaWorld and other marine parks around the company. So they're in the process of educating these large tourism companies about, you know, is it okay for people to go visit marine parks, and should you be referring your clients to places like SeaWorld or Loro Park or Marineland as part of their vacation packages? So that's another thing that's going on, and the people in these tourism companies are starting to listen. Did you want to add something?
I was going to ask, now, is it right that the UK no longer has any dolphinariums?
Yeah, the UK no longer has any dolphinariums, and that is not because they're illegal. It's because the legislation makes it really challenging to have a dolphinarium there. I think it's just the requirements for per animal are so large that it's cost prohibitive. Yeah, so it keeps anybody from coming in and doing it. But it's not that it's impossible. I guess if you had enough money, you could do it. But nobody's done it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So have you or someone you've known recently visited SeaWorld?
Well, I was at SeaWorld in San Diego last year during the American Cetacean Society Conference, and then also I was just at Loro Park in the Canary Islands, which is kind of like SeaWorld.
Sure.
They have a pretty close relationship, actually. So I was there, and really since I've been involved with this movie, the last time after I quit SeaWorld in August of 93, and I did not set foot in another marine park until this year.
That's
and then,
almost 20 years.
Yeah, and so now I've been to, I went to the Miami Seaquarium, I went to SeaWorld of San Diego, and I've been to Loro Park.
So what have you noticed? Tell us what you've noticed over that 20-year period, because obviously there have been many factors that have affected change. Time has moved on, et cetera. But
and nothing has changed. That's the really sad part. They are still doing the same tricks. They like to call them behaviors, but they're still the same tricks. They still use the same sequences in the shows. They still use the same the same quote education unquote is being sold to the public. They still say that the whales that killer whales, for instance, only live 25 to 35 years. And of course, we've had statistics for over 40 years that show that that's not true. Female whales can live well into their 90s, and males, you know, 50 or 60. They still say that the it's normal for killer whales in the wild to have curved dorsal fins, that 25% of whales in the wild have curved dorsal fins. That's not true. It's about 1%. And even then, the animals who have collapsed dorsal fins in the wild are generally very sick or they've been injured.
Okay.
You know, so it's not normal.
It's 100%.
It's 100% of SeaWorld's male killer whales have curved dorsal fins, and a good percentage of their female whales. They still say that they feed their animals restaurant quality fish, which really has no meaning. It's frozen fish that's been thawed, and then it loses a good percentage of the moisture and the vitamins and minerals. So you know, they also describe still what they do with the animals' dental care as superior dental care. And this is actually one of the larger tragedies and one of the reasons why these animals die often very young in captivity at places like SeaWorld and Loro Park. What happens is the animals, specifically the killer whales, will chew on the steel bars of the gates between the pools, or they'll chew on the sides of the pools, or they'll do something called jaw popping at each other, which is an aggression display. But eventually what happens is they break their teeth, and then the SeaWorld vets have to go in and drill these boreholes. They drill out the pulp in their teeth all the way down to the jaw. When I was there, it was done without anesthetic. I've heard now that they might be using anesthetic, but I can't verify that because I didn't see it. And then they have these open boreholes in their teeth. And so three times a day, they have to flush their teeth with a betadine solution to keep them from going septic or getting infected. And they still characterize that to the public as superior dental care, you know, and it's basically an artifact of captivity. I did not see, it was actually very disheartening to me to watch the shows, because it really wasn't any different than anything that I'd been doing when I was there. What's even worse is at the Miami Seaquarium to see the animal Lolita, who I mentioned earlier. Lolita is a member of the southern resident population. In the movie Blackfish, you actually see her being captured from her family. So she's been in captivity for over 43 years. She's been by herself, except for dolphins. Her last male killer whale companion died in 1980. His name was Hugo. And she's still in the same tiny tank. You can see pictures on the internet of aerial shots of her in this little tank. It's the smallest tank in North America. She barely has room to turn around in this tank. And if you look at the facility, I mean, it's rather worn down. There's algae, there's rust, and you know, it hasn't been upgraded since she's been there. So that hasn't changed at all.
You know, there's a couple of things. One thing they like to say to any criticism is we're the world's leading zoological institution for marine mammals. They like to say we do great conservation work, and they also like to say we are, you know, we do research. So what do you say about that? Has that changed since you were?
Yeah, that's another great question. And I'm always asking, you know, what kind of research, you know, is done at SeaWorld. And, you know, when I was there, all I saw was research that was basically aimed at how do we keep these animals alive in captivity so we can profit from them longer. The only external scientist who I saw in my 3.5 years there was a guy named Frank Fish, who came in. That was his actual name. And he was doing a hydrodynamic study. He was looking at how water moved over these animals in the water as they swam. And mm-hmm. he would watch the animals swim standing in front of the front glass of the Shamu Stadium and also at Whale and Dolphin Stadium. And he was taking video, and then he was going back and making some mathematical calculations. And I think that that information was going to be used either in the boating industry or maybe in the aeronautics industry. But it wasn't anything to benefit wild whales. They also say that they are involved in, you know, rehabbing and returning animals to the wild. But to answer that, I can tell you the story about Morgan, which is the reason I was at Laurel Park in the Canary Islands. Morgan was a killer whale. She was a young female killer whale who was captured in the Netherlands. And she was brought into the Dolphinarium Harderwijk in the Netherlands under a rehab and release permit. The idea being that she would be brought into the Dolphinarium, and when she was healthy enough, she was sick when they found her, so they felt that when she was healthy enough, they could return her to the wild. She comes from Norway and her pods in Norway. So at a certain point while she was at the Dolphinarium in Harderwijk, it was determined that she was not healthy enough to go back to the wild. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, this determination was made. There were 7 experts who were pulled. There were veterinarians and former marine mammal experts who were given information about Morgan. And we now know that the information that was given to them was based on Morgan's statistics within a month of her being captured, not the state that she was in actually after being at the Dolphinarium Harderwijk for over a year. And so it was determined that she was not fit to go back into the wild. And although there was a trial in the Netherlands, before the trial even happened, there was already permitting paperwork to move her to Laurel Park in the Canary Islands. So Morgan, a wild killer whale, was moved to Laurel Park in the Canary Islands, where she was put amongst 5 juvenile killer whales that were born in captivity. So for her, they don't speak whale. The whales there do not speak whale. I don't know what they speak, but it must be like for her living kind of an insane asylum. And not only that, killer whales are a matriarchal society. So the head whale there is a whale named Keto. He's the whale that actually killed Alexis Martinez, which you saw in the movie Blackfish. And Keto is a teenager basically, and he's in charge of the pod. The other animals there are there's a baby named Aiden. There is Skyla, and I'm blanking on the other names right now. But anyway, she gets Takoa. Blanking on his name right now. But anyway, she gets beat up pretty relentlessly there. She doesn't get along with the other whales, and now Laurel Park is saying that in fact that they believe that she's deaf. So this is another reason why she can't return to the wild. So basically what it comes down to is SeaWorld has gotten themselves another whale, because SeaWorld, the whales that are currently at Laurel Park were brought to Laurel Park on a, quote, breeding loan from SeaWorld. They're owned by SeaWorld, and now they have this female whale who's now potentially worth millions of dollars to them because she can potentially produce calves for SeaWorld. So, of course, they don't want to let her go. So this is an example of, you know, an animal that could have been returned to the wild, but now because of her situation, she's also getting very stressed out, and she's already chewing on the sides of the pools, and she's wearing her teeth down. There's pictures on the internet. You can see it's already getting to the point where she may need to have regular veterinary care, and it may be impossible to return her to the wild if she's there for much longer.
So, there's no better case of captivity affecting the health and well-being of the whale.
So worldwide, are there any other instances of killer whales being added to displays and places?
Well, unfortunately, Russia just captured, now it's a total of 8 killer whales, and 2 of them are going to be on display at the Sochi Olympics. So that is another thing that and killer whale captures on that level have not happened since the 80s. So the Russians are really ramping things up. And I think that they see a potential for money making probably in the Japanese market and also in China, where there's a market for, you know, captive marine mammals.
When you say market for captive marine mammals,
they're starting to, well, especially in China, the money's there now to build facilities equivalent equivalent to SeaWorld or even larger. And the population is, you know, looking for these kinds of amusement parks, and they're not educated necessarily as this population, you know, in the UK and the EU and the United States. We're starting to get the message out there that there are certain animals that don't belong in captivity. I don't think that in China in particular, or in Russia, that people
kind of
are,
sensitivity
exactly, that they're not really aware that these animals don't do well in
tanks.
So
that's a pressure and a move in the direction. At the present time, though, in Russia, China, Japan, are there any SeaWorld-type places?
Yes, there are. There's definitely in Japan. I don't know what the number is, how many there are in Japan.
Okay.
But, yeah, they have quite a few dolphinariums and false killer whales and dolphins in captivity, and I believe several killer whales in captivity as well. I don't know too much about the situation in Japan right now, but what I do know is about The Cove, which that movie came out in 2009, and that movie follows Rick O'Berry, who's the original trainer for Flipper from the TV series in the 60s. And Rick O'Berry became anti-captivity after one of his dolphins from the Flipper TV show died in his arms at the Miami Seaquarium. And he's been, it's hard to believe, but he's been an activist for almost 50 years now, speaking out against captivity. And The Cove follows him going to Taiji in Japan, watching these dolphin drives. And you can go online now, and Sea Shepherd is sponsoring a live stream every day. You can actually watch what happens when the boats go out and they herd these animals into the coves, and they net them off, and then they just brutally murder them. And prior to their getting murdered, trainers from marine parks in Japan come and they pick out the best looking animals, and they load them up on trucks and they take them out. So they make, you know, $100,000 for a dolphin. I don't know what they get for a false killer whale. I don't know, you know, their estimates on killer whales, you know, upwards of $1 million. So they make huge amounts of money for the display animals, and then the animals that aren't pristine looking end up getting slaughtered. And, of course, the meat is highly contaminated with mercury and all sorts of toxins. And then they try to put this meat into school lunches for kids. There's even a dolphinarium in Japan that they were looking at where you could watch the animals perform and then go have dolphin meat for lunch. So pretty horrifying.
Okay, so that's a picture to the east. In the United States at the present time, has the SeaWorld type of display come ground to a halt in terms of expanding?
Well, when you talk about expanding, when you talk about facilities, there were four SeaWorlds at one point: SeaWorld of California, SeaWorld of Florida, SeaWorld of Texas, SeaWorld of Ohio. Ohio was a part-time operation, just running in the summer. Now it's owned by Six Flags. So there are three main locations for SeaWorld, and of course, Laurel Park. They have their animals there, but it's not considered a SeaWorld facility. The Shamu stadiums at those three SeaWorlds were built in the late 80s and early 90s, and they were only built because it was the vets understood that the babies were not surviving because the female whales didn't have basically big enough circles to swim for the calves to latch on and get milk. So they realized that in order to get the calves to survive, they had to build bigger facilities.
Okay.
So those facilities were built in the late 80s and early 90s, and they haven't been expanded since. And in some cases, you've got facilities that now have 10, 11, 12 killer whales. So they're rather small considering that, you know, a female killer whale, a female Icelandic can be about 5,000 or 6,000 pounds. Corky, who's at SeaWorld in San Diego, she's a northern resident. She's quite a bit bigger. She might be even getting close to 8,000 pounds or 9,000 pounds. And then there's Tillicum, you know, the whale that has killed three people. He's in Orlando, and he's 12,000 pounds and 22 feet long. He's like the size of a school bus. So only two of the pools at Shamu Stadium in Orlando are deeper than he is long, basically.
Okay. So I'm getting the picture that at least in the United States, for whatever reason, there hasn't been an expansion since the 80s of the facilities, nor the number of facilities that existed?
I don't, you know, the Georgia Aquarium, I think, is probably one of the newer facilities. So there haven't been new facilities built, but that hasn't kept them from still bringing dolphins in and trading dolphins around and laundering animals through different facilities. But no, they haven't, where the money is gone in most of these facilities. And I think, to be fair, I think that they've realized that there is a a limited amount of time left on the animal display side of the business. So they've been putting, to give you an example, when they put in the new show at Shamu Stadium, when they put in the Believe show a few years ago, they spent several million dollars upgrading the lighting system at Shamu Stadium. None of that money went into upgrading the facility. They put several million dollars into upgrading the hot dog stand right outside of the Killer Whale Stadium. So they're constantly upgrading their roller coasters and their rides, but the animal facilities are not getting the same financial attention, which is sad because the animals are generating quite a bit of the revenue at the gate, at least according to SeaWorld's own figures. So they're a $2.2 billion company, and they say that about 70% of their revenue comes from the fact that they have killer whales in captivity. 70% of their revenue is not going into making better facilities for the killer whale at the parks, at the killer whales at the parks.
Okay. So you've done this trip, and you've been involved in this whole business 20 years ago. You left as a trainer. I'm talking here with Samantha Berg, who is a former SeaWorld trainer. Killer whales, and has been a principal involved with the movie Blackfish, and lives here in Palmer. So you come back from Europe, you and Kevin both. What would you say was the major impact on you of this trip?
I'll just jump in there. To see the power of collaboration, what Daniel Turner from the Born Free Foundation made happen is really unprecedented. He brought together 20 NGOs from, was it 7 different countries. Typically, they're not always very easy relationships. They don't always agree on things. Mm-hmm. And there's many cultural differences. And he got them together, partnering around the movie Blackfish, and promoted a film which is really outside of the scope of his job description. And what he actually made happen is extraordinary. And it created more press than any of those organizations had accumulated in 20 years, what he was able to do in just a few weeks. He calculated it as several millions of dollars of press that was accomplished. Mm-hmm. And the momentum of the film in Europe, is incredible.
Yeah, every single country we went into, we got, if there were 3 major TV stations and 5 major newspapers, I mean, we hit almost all of them in every country. It was quite amazing how many interviews we did.
Sam, you started out by talking about Born Free and, mm-hmm. and that particular issue and series of events. As I'm listening to you, I'm beginning to think that although the focus we've had has been on killer whales in captivity, and given the variety of organizations that have had other interests of focus for animals in captivity, what would you say the spinoff is for the bigger picture of zoos, other situations?
Yeah, that's an awesome question.
That?
I mean, well, right now, one of the organizations that that I think is important to know about is the Non-Human Rights Project, and that's run by a lawyer named Stephen Wise. And Stephen's devoted his life to getting non-human personhood status for one animal to start out with. And right now, they have just filed a lawsuit in New York State on behalf of a chimp that was being used in research, I think being used for gait research. Mm-hmm. And that lawsuit was rejected, but they expected that to happen, and now it's gone to an appellate court in mm-hmm. New York. And so that's really where the big work is coming in, this on appeal. And so the idea here is that I've heard Stephen speak and talk a little bit about what this is that if you take a look, there's certain animals that meet the status basically to be considered non-human persons. And so those would be animals that have, a large range. They have, large brain size to body mass ratio. They take care of their young for a significant portion of time. They've demonstrated a certain amount of intelligence. They use tools. In that category, you could put great apes. You could definitely put dolphins and whales. And you could also add in animals that we know don't do well in captivity, like big cats, bears, elephants, another animal very similar to killer whales in terms of their social structure. And the whole point of this project is to get non-human personhood status. Once you get one of these animals as being considered a non-human person, then you have a container in which you can put rights. And so to put that into perspective, right now the SeaWorld killer whales and any animals in a zoo or any animal being used in research, they are considered property. And so if you're property, you don't have any rights. So think about similar to slavery or, you know, even women 200 years ago. You know, mm-hmm. they were considered property. They didn't have any rights. So in order to be not considered property, you have to be designated a non-human person first. Once you're a non-human person, then you basically have a container into which you can put rights. Now, this isn't saying a lot of people go take this argument down. They say, oh, slippery slope. Now we're going to end up with my dog and cat having more rights than me. And that's not what it's about. There are animal welfare laws that tell us how we can take care of these animals. But there are certain animals, just because of the level of intelligence and the kind of social structures that they have and the fact that we know that we can't meet their needs in captivity, they deserve more than we can give them basically in a zoo or a circus kind of facility. So these animals should be designated with some rights that would, you know, give them that would prevent them from being used in these kind of situations like scientific research or in a circus or at a zoo.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what's next for you?
And that's a really good question. I have no idea, but, you know, every day is different. I have no idea what's coming at me every day. I get requests all the time from schools all over the country to Skype in on discussions. There are teachers showing the movie Blackfish, mm-hmm. and I get the opportunity to do Skype calls or Google calls. We actually had this past weekend, there's a performance artist named Amber Hawk Swenson, and she, a couple of years ago, she actually dismantled one of those life-size dolls and turned it into Tilikum as part of a live stream performance. And I was invited to speak about killer whale captivity along with another one of my colleagues, Jeffrey Ventry, on that show. She just did a follow-up to that this past weekend. She took apart two other dolls and turned them into Lolita on a live stream TV. So that's kind of out there, but I got to actually talk about...
So I heard what you said,
yes.
But I have no idea what that looks like.
I know.
Tell the audience a little bit more.
I will explain a little bit more. So Amber's a performance artist, and you can go on Facebook and learn a little bit about this project. It's called Mark Sidor 2, and I'm forgetting the name of the other doll. But anyway, so you can look up Amber on the internet, and she's a performance artist. And what she did was she took these basically life-size anatomically correct dolls that you can get for $6,000, and she dismantled the doll. She took the skin off the skeleton frame of the doll and then refitted it onto the skeleton that she made out of the doll's skeleton and turned it into basically a killer whale. So she morphed these human dolls into... Kevin's looking for a picture right now. So she morphed these human dolls into killer whales, two captive killer whales. So I will let you think about what the metaphor is in there, but there's a lot of them. You can see the picture of Amber with her with the dolls before and with the new sculpture of both Tilikum and Lolita. So that was kind of fun to be invited to do something like that. Basically, I just got Jeffrey Ventry and I got a chance to talk about the issues around killer whales in captivity on her show. She just gave us 45 minutes to talk about that. I was also just interviewed for a show called Party Rockers Tween Scene, which is kind of like a Nickelodeon show.
Okay, let me say that slowly.
Party Rockers tween scene. Yeah.
And so, you've moved on, Sam.
Yeah, I know. And so, I got interviewed by somebody. It's kind of like a Nickelodeon show for kids, and I got interviewed on that show. I've Skyped into also last weekend there was a show in Germany that I did a Skype Q&A. Captain Paul Watson from Sea Shepherd went on first after they showed Blackfish, and then I came on second and mm-hmm. And just did a question and answer session after the movie. So the big thing, though, is that Blackfish just made the short list for the Academy Awards. So there's a list of 15 documentary films on the short list, and Blackfish is listed as number 5. So it's possible that it could get an Academy Award nomination. And so if that happens, it's going to get even more press. So I have no idea, you know, where I'm going or what I'm doing next. I think you asked earlier how I actually even ended up on the tour in Europe because of, you know, it just was one of those things where they were looking for either the director or the producer or one of the former trainers to go on tour in Europe. And just because of the job that I do, because I'm self-employed, I was actually able to take off time to do that. So, you know, one of the things is that there's been a lot of – opportunities to travel, but this is something that all of us who've been participating in this film, none of us are getting paid to do this. So it's really like, you know, it's pretty much on our own time to
Understand.
Do this. So yeah, so the opportunity, there's a lot more opportunities to go places than I can possibly take people up on. I was invited to go to Egypt. Don't know if that's going to be something that can happen. Costa Rica, Borneo. There's an invite to go to. So there's lots of different places that we've all been invited to go.
We could wonder a little bit why you get a call from Borneo, or for that matter, from some places and not others. But it sounds as if this whole process has not tapered off.
No.
It's building.
It seems to be building still. So, yeah. So I really don't know what's next, but I know that, I mean, I'm on Twitter and I'm on Facebook. And in fact, if people want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at Sam10K. You can also follow at Voice of the Orcas. So that's at @voice_OT_orcas. And I tweet from both of those accounts. And you can follow, or you can go, again, you can Google Voice of the Orcas. There's a Google site. And you can follow what's going on. But literally, there's developments every day. I mean, there's things changing. I know we just won the Washington, D.C. Area Critics Best Documentary Award last week, and it's up for another Critics Award. I don't know where that one is from, but I just saw that this morning. So award season's coming up, so there's a lot of award nominations that are going on. And then we were invited. There's going to be a panel discussion at Northeastern University in January, so that's another possibility. So there's so many people who are trying to get the information out, and they really want the principals in the movie to come speak or have the director speak. And, you know, Gabriella Cowperthwaite is an amazing woman, and it would be great if she could clone herself, because I know she has got so many – she's got more engagements than she knows what to do with. So, I mean, she's so busy right now trying to keep up with it. So, you know, that means that, you know, those of us – you know, the former trainers in the film – We get to do some stuff that she can't do too as well. So who knows?
So we have about 2 minutes, and what I'm going to do is give Kevin 2 minutes.
Okay.
or less. But Kevin, you've been observing this, and in fact participating in this process for some time now. Any last comments? What do you see?
Well, I think that the momentum in the public is building. It's hard to say where it's going to go. It's a revelatory film. I mean, people are seeing things in this film they haven't really given a lot of thought about. And SeaWorld has always been a culturally acceptable icon. I mean, people have gone to SeaWorld and felt good about it. It's like something they do good for their family. And for the first time, they're actually seeing the truth. And people are appreciative to know the truth and the facts, but they're also pissed off. They're angry. Mm-hmm. I think that people, they want to be told the truth. And I think more and more the general public sentiment is that there's so much corporate corruption and political corruption that when they see it and they see they've been taken yet again, and they want to do something about it. And the thing is, SeaWorld and the issues of whales in captivity is an easy solution. You just don't buy a ticket. And so there's a way of exerting your sense of values and your integrity and your love for animals by being supportive to this film and sharing your passion with other people. And I think that's probably part of why this film is just building and building and building. It's hitting a cultural sentiment right now, and it's an easy one to respond to. And it's actually very positive, because you see the journey the trainers have taken in the film. You see them coming, reckoning with their own conscience, and then having the courage to speak up. And when you see people do that, and it's really authentic, and in this film, the trainers, you really get it. They're from their heart. And when you go on that journey with them, at the end of the film, if you're not crying, you are passionately awakened to your own conscience, and you want to do something. So, I mean, that's what this film does. It's what it's done for me. And just to watch Sam go through her own process and now become an international spokesperson and advocate for the whales has been incredible. And I'm just, I'm so blown away. And the knowledge base that you've built to give yourself a broader impact in this emerging scene is something to behold. It's beautiful.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Kevin. That leaves Sam, you have a minute. Any last comment?
Yeah, I think everybody always asks me, you know, what do we do now after we've seen the movie? And just like Kevin said, don't buy a ticket. Also encourage, you know, it's not just SeaWorld. You know, SeaWorld is actually the biggest player in the industry. But because SeaWorld exists, there are all these smaller facilities that exist. And some of them are way worse than SeaWorld. So just go out there, get educated, encourage them to stop the breeding programs, you know, write letters. And, of course, you know, if you can find politicians who are sympathetic to your cause in a place where there are marine parks and aquariums, get a hold of them, write letters to them, and let them know that this is not right, this is not wholesome family entertainment. You know, that we are these places, in fact, do exploit and abuse animals for human entertainment, and it's time to stop. So I think that that it's really important to just get vocal and, you know, buy a copy of Blackfish, share it with your family, share it with your friends, buy a copy of Death at SeaWorld, just talk about it. And I think the big thing that Kevin said, I think it's also a metaphor for, you know, just the levels of corporate corruption that most people are aware of at this point. It's not, this doesn't just happen at a place like SeaWorld. This unfortunately happens in a lot of corporations. And it's not just the animals that are not being well taken care of. It's the employees as well. So I think it, again, brings to the forefront the larger issue of, you know, Do we stand up for what's right in this country, or do we just sit around and be told what's right, you know, be told what to think, and just, you know, watch TV and keep our mouths shut? So I, for one, after being through this experience, you know, even if every single whale was out of captivity tomorrow, I would still be out there talking about some of the issues that I've seen just being out there in the world now and knowing that there's a lot of injustices that need our attention, and this is just one of them.
Okay, thank you. We've been talking with Samantha Berg, a former SeaWorld killer whale trainer and principal involved with Blackfish, the movie. Thank you for coming in tonight and sharing, giving an update. And thank you, Kevin, for adding some color there. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you.